DeVille. He's the managing editor at Stereo Gum, and we're talking about his new book, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Chris, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's great to be here.
This is one of those books I was really looking forward to reading, and it didn't let me down. So thank you for writing it. This is a very personal rock history, and sort of in the introduction, I love your own sort of coming into indie rock. What's your story about how you discovered indie rock?
Yeah, so I mean, I was in high school in the late 90s around Y2K, and I was into a lot of the rock music that was popular with kids at the time, like, you know, what was being played on MTV and the radio. So that meant a lot of like nu metal, Metallica, just a lot of stuff that I could practice my shredding guitar in the basement, you know, download the guitar tab from the internet and learn how to do like Dimebag Darrell riffs and stuff. And then at some point I just got really into Radiohead through a friend of mine. He was like my hookup for new bands. And that kind of led me into the world of like online, like best of album lists and stuff. And eventually there was just a list that was not all the year end lists were like the same albums everywhere. But then I found one that had all these albums that I'd never heard of by bands like Modest Mouse and Yola Tango and like Sigur Rós and just all these bands that were at the time very underground still. And it was like it opened up this whole new world to me of like underground rock, which is funny because I talk about this, a lot of the bands that were popular in the 90s had come from that world, like Nirvana.
Yep.
And I kind of picked up on it maybe like a decade later and caught the next wave.
Is there a clean definition of alt rock?
I don't feel like there is, because it's like that famous compilation album, Alternative to What? But it's like,
is it defined like year by year?
I think it is. I mean, like, I like to talk about how pop is like it's more of a container for what's popular than like a specific style or sound, because, you know, pop, the sound of what's in the mainstream evolves. And so it's like in politics, they talk about the Overton window. It's like whatever is, you know, kind of being discussed at the time, or whatever it's like, you know, considered appropriate to discuss. So, yeah, I feel like alternative rock, indie rock, it's always evolving. With indie, it's interesting because it started with an actual term, independent. This is music that's being released independently, therefore it's indie rock. But then over the years, it kind of took on some aesthetic characteristics and it became more of a genre. And then the genre itself started to get a little blurry, like, okay, so what exactly is this genre? Like, because it... so many different factors came in that I tried to cover in the book. So yeah, it's like, it's so funny. I spend the whole book trying to define what indie means. And I'm not sure that I ever land on a firm definition.
No, you don't.
It feels so slippery.
You don't. And I didn't think you could. So fair enough. But one of the things that comes out through your book is this sort of tension that exists between indie bands and commercial pop. And there's always this, the fans, especially of certain indie bands, can sometimes get really sort of pugnacious when a band gets signed to a major label. And that tension comes out throughout your book, and that still exists. And that existed when I was back in the rock world back in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, it is, as soon as a band gets signed by a major label, everybody goes, well, you know, they used to be good.
Right. And I think it's funny because, like, for the millennials like me, I feel like we sort of softened on that to some extent. Which is part of what I was tracing.
Yeah,
the changing of attitudes about that kind of thing.
You know, for bands like Postal Service and stuff like that, which I just listened to just before we did this interview, it's very accessible rock, and it's synth driven. There's a lot of synth beats in it, and that sort of bridged that world between the indie and the commercial.
Right.
But there are still fans that are going to be upset.
It's funny because there's still bands now that are like
abrasively.
You know, you're always gonna have the hipsters who want to celebrate certain things and trash other things. And it's like for a time there, once we got to the 2010s, it felt like it was inverted, where it was like the hipsters were celebrating the pop and kind of turning their nose up at the more indie stuff. It was kind of a weird time. That was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, was to kind of trace, you know, how did we get to the point where, like, the hipsters were more interested in Beyonce than in, you know, like, historically I would have thought that they would be interested in these obscure guitar bands. And so, but yeah, I feel like we're kind of moving back now in the 2020s towards a little bit of that old mentality of, like, I mean, I think we kept... What people gained a lot during the 2000s and 2010s, especially with MP3s and with MySpace and all that, like, I feel like people gained a really eclectic taste. Mm-hmm. Like, people are less likely to define themselves by one genre. But I think that maybe we're moving back towards a little bit more suspicion of kind of, like, quote unquote sellout music, or music that, you know, kind of takes its grit away in order to, you know, sound better at Chipotle or whatever.
Well, there's so many topics that you talk about in this book, and I want to talk about one of them that I found fascinating, was what the relationship between television shows and film and alternative music, indie music. Let's start with The O.C. Now, I never watched an episode of The O.C., but what was The O.C.? It was a television show.
Yeah, so The O.C. was basically a teen soap opera. It was like the next big thing after Beverly Hills 90210. It was like, you know, rich, beautiful teens in California. One of the characters on the show, Seth Cohen, he really defined himself as an indie rock fan, and he name checked all these bands that at the time were quite obscure, like Death Cab for Cutie and Bright Eyes. Like, these are bands that are fairly well known now, but at the time it was like really coming out of nowhere. And it was because the guy who created the show had been into that kind of music, and he kind of viewed this guy as like his own personal avatar within the show. But it really put, I mean, they made it such a big part of the show that by the second season, this character Seth was working at a music venue, and they had all these rising indie bands come and perform on the show. And it really put the indie rock in front of an audience that hadn't traditionally been consuming that, or like even, you know, really knowing about some of these bands. And it created this sort of off-ramp to, it was like a direct pathway if you were wanted to be like a poppy accessible indie band, you know, the OC was there to kind of platform you to put you in front of an audience that was hungry for probably a poppier version of indie rock. And so then, like, this is around the same time as Zach Braff's Garden State.
Oh, yeah.
Got this
classic soundtrack album.
Yeah, exactly. So the soundtrack to Garden State was a huge hit, won a Grammy. It was like they were talking about it on SNL. And that movie's got the sort of infamous scene where Natalie Portman has her headphones and it's like, you got to listen to this song. It'll change your life. And it's the Shins. And so this was all 2003, 2004-ish. And over the next few years, we had this kind of cottage industry of movies where indie rock was like part of the plot. Because, like, I think there's always been movie soundtracks that had these sort of hip bands on them, and like Hollywood directors, you know, there's always been like cool music in movies, but this was something different where it was like very much part of the plot and was like driving the plot. And so, yeah, that was definitely part of what made this sort of millennial generation of indie bands catch on with a much broader audience.
I love in your book, you describe indie rock becomes a lifestyle brand.
Mm-hmm.
and
it really did.
And for the Shins, though, being in Garden State was really a mixed blessing. The Village Voice ran a piece titled "The Shins Ruined Indie Rock."
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that was by my current coworker Tom Bryan. He works with me at Stereo Gum right now.
And I mean, was a lot of that was propelled by the fact that they were becoming well known because of the film.
Yeah, so there was a few different dynamics at play. Like, they were becoming well known, and so there were some people who were like, "Oh, well, I liked them when I liked their older stuff. I liked when
that classic line."
Yeah. I liked them before everybody else knew about them, but
right.
now they're not my little secret anymore. I think Tom, in that particular piece, was also think he felt like they were kind of soft and like there wasn't much aggression in the music, there wasn't much edge to the music, and he felt like they were contributing to indie rock becoming music that could work as pleasant background music. Like, when we think about like Spotify now, it's like they really try to target a passive listening experience. It's almost like Muzak. And this was 20 years ago that he wrote this piece about the Shins. But yeah, like, that was the direction that he felt like things were going, was this used to be this really gritty underground music that had a lot of edge to it, and you had to really be invested to be involved in it. And, you know, you had to dig a little bit, and now it's just out there, and it's easy listening, basically, was the case that he was making.
Well, there's also a sense, and you write about this in the book, a sense of ownership of the band by the listener. I found this, I embraced it, I promoted it, and now it's everybody's.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, I think that that's been a dynamic for a long time, and I'm not sure if that has changed. Like, I think there's still an aspect of early adopter type listeners who, like, they really like being the first ones to know about something. But once a critical mass of people get into it, it's like it suddenly feels cringe to them or something. Like, oh, well, I can't be excited about this thing that everybody else is excited about, because that's not who I am. I'm like, you know, I'm the special, unique flower. I'm not.
And the problem is, 10 years later, then you'll re-embrace it.
Nobody
else is listening to it anymore. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer, columnist Chris DeVille. He's the managing editor at Stereo Gum, and we're talking about his book, Such Great Heights: The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Chris, you should explain the title of the book for people who don't
know. Yeah, okay. So it's called Such Great Heights because that refers to the song by the Postal Service, which is the band with Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie as the singer. And then there was Jimmy Tamborello, an electronic producer. And in 2003, they released an album on Sub Pop Records, which, you know, is famous for launching Nirvana. It's kind of associated with Seattle and grunge. And it's this synth pop album. And so it was really surprising at the time that it's like, oh, it's a synth pop album by an indie rock singer on Sub Pop Records. And Such Great Heights is the big sort of hit single from that album. And I felt like it was a good title for the book because I was tracing this trajectory of indie rock kind of morphing into pop music and also achieving a mainstream presence, like sort of soaring to great heights. And so it felt like it was a good title on a couple of levels. My original subtitle for the book was actually How Indie Rock Went Pop. We changed it to The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion later because my publisher thought that that would be better. But definitely the idea of this metamorphosis from underground rock into a form of pop music was sort of driving my narrative. So I felt like the Postal Service was a great band to use as like sort of the title song.
We're barely scratching the surface of the first 50 pages. I want you to talk about the coming of Pitchfork and why it was so important and put it in the cultural context of the time.
So Pitchfork was a big deal. This is a, online music magazine. It still exists today, still very, still has a loyal readership, still makes people mad with its scores for new albums. But Pitchfork was sort of like the first website that was consistently writing about indie rock and independent music online. It launched in the mid-90s. I discovered it right around the year 2000, like when I was, having that indie rock awakening of my own. And they built up a very loyal audience because they were, for one thing, they were publishing multiple reviews, like 5 reviews per day. You didn't have to wait for the review to come out in a magazine that's going to come out once a month, or for the more underground stuff, there was, handmade zines that were photocopied at Kinko's and mailed around the country. You didn't have to wait. There was no lag time because it was online. And at the same time, they had very strong opinions. They were this stuff is great. This stuff is trash. And they built up a very loyal readership, of which I was included, who were willing to take cues from it because they had, in my opinion, such a good hit rate on the stuff that they said was good. Now, some of the stuff that they trashed probably deserved better.
A good example in the book, Clap Your Hands and Say Yeah, where hype sort of morphed into backlash, and they could definitely ruin a band.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah is one where I think they probably did more to help them just because, they were so excited about their first album. By the time the second album came along, everybody was like, oh, we're shrugging now. It's because, we're on to the next big thing. Kind of the classic example for them of them destroying somebody's career was Travis Morrison from the band The Dismemberment Plan, which is one of my all-time favorite bands, who I discovered through Pitchfork because Pitchfork was so enthusiastic about them. But then when he put out his solo album in 2004, they hated it so much they gave it a 0.0. And they had developed so much taste-making power by then that, nobody bought the album after that. Record stores were sending it back to the distributor because they just had all this stock that was, not moving. And it was it was just this weird, Pied Piper phenomenon where it's if they said something was great, people just believed it was great. And if they said something was garbage, people believed it was garbage. But they were a big part of the sort of indie rock star making pipeline. They really helped launch some of these bands. Like Arcade Fire is one of the classic examples of a band that they got all this blog hype and then that moved up. It was sort of the blogs were sort of the alley-oop, and then Pitchfork giving it a rave review was sort of the slam dunk. And from then it was off to the races.
Now, a term that came up eventually as a form of criticism of indie rock was rockism.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, so there's this whole, this is kind of a nerdy music critic inside baseball thing, but the term, there's rockism and poptimism.
Right.
And it's like, the idea is basically, poptimism is supposed to be that everything deserves a fair shake, and we shouldn't just reject entire genres, and we should, you know, stuff that maybe we would consider a certain type of genre to be pretty fluffy historically or, like, insubstantial, but, like, that music appeals to someone, and we should try to figure out why it appeals, and maybe there's some value in it, and we shouldn't just write things off before giving everything a fair shake. So that's supposed to be the idea of it. But sometimes there's a more simplistic version of it, which is just basically, if it's popular, that must mean it's good. And so there's a lot of competing definitions of poptimism. And then rockism is sort of like the what stands in opposition to that, where it's like you just assume that if it's by, you know, if it features guitars, it's better than if it features synths. And if it's by, like, a, you know, a solemn old man, like, you know, Bob Dylan or something, that it's more important than if it's by, like, you know, a teenage girl, and so on and so forth. And so the idea was that a lot of these inherited biases that people were bringing to rock criticism were kind of aligning with, like, misogyny and racism and stuff. So it definitely, it was a big ideological current in music criticism over the last couple of decades, even before that, but I feel like it really reached a fever pitch in the late 2000s and on into the 2010s. And so, yeah, it was like the pendulum kind of swung probably too far in the other direction, where it was like people who had historically been into indie rock got very, very excited about pop music. And, I mean, I was right there with them. So, like, that's a very convoluted and it often tiresome debate that happens in the music critic world. And it definitely influenced which bands were getting hype as the years went on.
There's a great section of your first CMJ conference, 3-day conference. And I think you saw the band, it was in 2003. I think you saw the band Arcade Fire then, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, I saw them in 04, but I was there in 03 also. Seeing Arcade Fire right after they had gotten their big Pitchfork endorsement, when their first album was just out and they were playing in like a 250 capacity room, it was very exciting for me. I just stood there. It's a CMJ music marathon. It's kind of like, it doesn't exist anymore, but it was like this, bands would play all over. It's a college radio festival and conference, and bands would play all over New York, kind of like South by Southwest in Austin. But it was just in venues all across town. And Arcade Fire was playing. They were headlining a showcase for Merge Records at the Mercury Lounge in Lower Manhattan. And yeah, I just stood there for like 6 hours in the front just waiting for
that's right
that
your
on.
Strategy to get a seat was to get show up like hours early, so then you had a seat.
Yeah, I was very serious about it. I was like, I'm not missing this, so I gotta make sure I get in there. And it's like I say in the book, it made perfect sense to me when I was an undergrad, and now that I'm like a 40 something dad, the idea of standing there for 6 hours sounds horrible, but you know, we have different priorities when we're young.
We're almost out of time. At this moment, just at this moment, what's a band you feel really strongly about personally?
This is kind of cliche among music critics right now, but I gotta say Geese.
Mm-hmm.
Geese is kind of like the big buzz band of the moment, and I think that they're really amazing. They're one of the bands that I think is bringing some of the rough edges and the weirdness back to indie rock, and people are really responding to it. They have a new album called Getting Killed.
Mm-hmm.
That, I compared it to, like, in my review, I said it was like half Rolling Stones, half Radiohead.
that sounds like a weird mutant.
It is a weird mutant, but like it.
So you are you pronounce? I always pronounced it Geist, and you're pronouncing it Geist.
G-E-E-S-E. I know.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Geist, like the animal, like.
Oh, I'm thinking of another band entirely. Okay, go ahead.
Oh yeah, yeah. Are you thinking of Feist?
That's what I'm thinking of.
Okay, yeah. Geist is like these like this sort of young crew from New York. They're on their third album. Their singer is Cameron Winter, and he just had a solo album last year called Heavy Metal that a lot of people connected with, and it built a lot of excitement for the new Geist album that just came out this year.
Cool.
So yeah, I recommend that. That's a band that I'm very excited about.
We're completely out of time. We should do another interview just about the whole middle section of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm down. Just let me know.
There's a whole, but if we were to do another interview, there's a section of this book I want to let the audience know about Michael Cera and his role in films and indie music. That was wild that you put that all together.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It was really fun to do.
It's great. My guest tonight is writer, columnist, Chris DeVille. He's the managing editor at Stereo Gum, and we're talking about his book, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Chris, it's been a pleasure.
Same here. I really appreciate you having me on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.